Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Interestingly enough, I just finished a long Zoom call with Sarah Longwell with a group up in Minnesota discussing the future of the Republican Party. And one of the questions was, you know, do we continue to call ourselves conservatives? What do we do with this word conservative? Which brings me to this piece that we had in the Bulwark last week. And I will say that of the pieces that we've run, I have thought about this one, I think more than pretty much any other. And if you have not read it, I would strongly recommend it. It's by Joshua Tate, who is a historian of conservatism. He's written his dissertation on this, and the headline was "The Long History of Fighting Over the Term Conservative." And he writes about the post-war circle of something called the New Conservatives, who tried to claim the world, that tried to claim the word conservative, but they lost and were largely forgotten. And we are lucky enough to have Joshua Tate with us on the podcast today. So thanks for joining me. I appreciate it very much, Joshua.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I ought to note that this is rather extraordinary. I think we've set a new record. I'm speaking to you. I'm in Wisconsin. You are in New Zealand. When we started this podcast, I said, you're actually in New Zealand right now.
Yeah, I am. I moved here for family reasons a little bit before COVID, and then COVID struck, and it turns out to be a pretty good place to ride it out.
And it's the miracle of modern technology that we're having this conversation. I just have to admit that I'm still geeked out by that. That I figured that there'd be like a, you know, 5-second delay between everything that I would say and your response, but it really sounds good. So let's talk about this new conservative. And I have to make a couple of confessions. I mentioned this to David Frum last week, and he knew every one of the names that you mentioned in the piece. He could, you know, knew about Peter Viereck, and he knew about Peter Viereck's father and the various issues that were involved there. And I have to confess, though, that as I was reading your piece, I was haunted by the idea that here you had this very significant movement with some very formidable figures, including Clinton Rossiter, who was one of the leading political scientists of his time, and yet it is almost completely forgotten. It was, in many ways, a failed attempt to reconceptualize conservatism. Is that too harsh to say, though, that their project did not succeed, and they were overwhelmed by what we now think of as the conservative movement, and as a result, they're kind of a footnote.
I think that's exactly right. I listened to the podcast with David Frum, and he is obviously a real student of conservatism. I remember citing him about a decade ago. He knows his stuff. I was very, very impressed. But yeah, I think you can find plenty of articles about Peter Viereck in particular online on conservative websites like the Intercollegiate Studies Institute. But it's very much, these were some people that were almost proto-conservative. They weren't true conservatives, which is how the Buckleyite right saw them at the time. And then, yeah, they were exactly as you described, overwhelmed. At one point, though, Partisan Review, the prominent left-wing journal, described conservatism or discussion about conservatism as reaching epidemic proportions in the early 1950s. So it was a moment, but then, yeah, as you say, we've completely forgotten them. I don't know if you'll like this analogy, but I sometimes think of them almost like, or they're almost treated like Neanderthals versus Homo sapiens. They were around with the Buckleyites. They were doing similar things, but they were, you know, outcompeted and are now completely forgotten.
Well, and also the spooky part, after reading your piece, I went online and I tried to find Clinton Rossiter's book, which is still being delivered, but it's not easy to find anymore, even though it was obviously a major piece. And I found a public television show from 1956 put on by Syracuse University, where folks are sitting around discussing Rossiter's book, and they're talking about, you know, what he meant by conservatism and whether or not his definition of conservatism would take root and what its appeal was. And I have to admit that what was actually haunting me even more than the Neanderthal Homo sapiens analogy was, it really sounded exactly like the way people talk about the Never Trumpers right now. Mm-hmm. that there was this intellectual movement trying to find a centrist approach to conservatism that might appeal to liberals, but that was a rejection of the more extreme elements. I mean, as you say, they envisioned, rather than just simply repudiating the New Deal, the new conservatives wanted to build on it while curbing its successes. They envisioned a conservatism as anti-fascist as it was anti-communist. So let's just talk about this, okay? Mm-hmm. Because a lot of the histories of the conservative movement would begin with, and then William F. Buckley said, "Let there be light," mm-hmm. and founded National Review. This is before this. This is early 1950s. The New Deal had been dominant in American politics. There was a conservative opposition. So who were these new conservatives and what were they pushing back against?
I think it's worth setting the scene a little bit.
Yeah, right.
Because in the late 1940s, early 1950s, you have a period where, everyone's just come out of the Depression, not only the economic struggles of the Depression, but the extreme politics of the Depression. Then you've had, before that, you had the First World War, and then you have the Second World War and the absolute human destruction, where you have, Germany, the most modern nation in the world, home of civilization in a lot of ways, descending into, utter evil destruction. And after that, you have a period of kind of settling down and a decision to, the public and kind of even the high culture looking for something to kind of rest on and find some stability or certainty in life. You have a massive resurgence in religion, especially in the middle class, and then even in the elite kind of intellectual circles, you have a turn to theologians like Kierkegaard or neo-Orthodox theology, or in Catholic circles, a resurgence in natural law. And so there's this culture-wide search for some sort of stability. And the new conservatives, I think, are one of the political manifestations of that. And they looked especially to Europe, and they also looked into the American past, and they thought, there are tools here for saying, we have something good, we have something that we don't want to throw away. Liberalism, procedural liberalism alone, is not sufficient to stand against the tyranny of fascism or the tyranny of communism. And maybe we need to start thinking of ourselves as conservatives, especially as we confront, the beginning of the Cold War. And over all of this is the threat of atomic war and nuclear destruction, and the idea that if we get too caught up in extreme politics, well, maybe that's lights out for everyone. And so you have a bunch of people like Peter Verich, like Clinton Rossiter, and a bunch of other names that I list in the piece, as well as kind of a broader circle of intellectuals that they draw on, people like Reinhold Niebuhr, who weren't necessarily or certainly didn't think of themselves as conservative, but I guess contributed to this overall feeling in society.
Not to oversimplify it, but they were thought of as kind of Eisenhower conservatives. If we're putting them on the political spectrum, they were, you describe Rossiter as painfully moderate. Mm-hmm. And so these would be people who politically would have been sort of pro Eisenhower, which again was rejected by the Buckley conservatives. Is that right, roughly?
Roughly, it gets complicated quickly.
I know, right.
Because they're all individual people with individual feelings, but they were publicly associated with Eisenhower, and some of them worked directly for Eisenhower or supported him. Others couldn't quite make the leap because they preferred Adlai Stevenson, who was seen in some ways as quite conservative, or they didn't like the way that Eisenhower was seen as unable to deal with Joseph McCarthy.
Okay, so why were they called new conservatives? You mentioned that there was a pre-existing American right. So let's talk about that. We're setting the scene, and you mentioned this pre-existing American right, the Liberty League veterans, anti-New Dealers, Republican stalwarts committed to rugged individualism. So again, what was the state of the conservative? Well, it wasn't really a movement, but conservatism. Pre the new conservatives. Who were the old conservatives, I guess?
The old conservatives, the old right. They were at this stage, well, we're talking about the right wing of the minority Republican Party at the stage, because we're still talking about the New Deal coalition, which hadn't kind of run out of steam yet. So they were the right wing of the smaller political party, the Republican Party. And then you also had very distinctly, you had the conservatives within the Democratic Party. So you had Southern conservatives, and neither they had not formed a single political coalition except on an ad hoc basis. So you had two kind of conservative groups, one of whom was very much a businessman's conservatism, the small government against the New Deal in a kind of a strident way, very much associated with laissez-faire economics, at least in the public view. And then on the Democratic side, you had, the association with states' rights. Mostly the new conservatives were thinking about the Republican right when they were talking about conservatism. And this is the press, when they talked about conservatives, often meant the Republican right. And what the new conservatives were doing, the way that they were trying to pitch themselves, was as true conservatives in the sense that they believed in reform, evolutionary development, conserving what they had, rather than what they saw the Republican right as, kind of radical Manchester liberals or, like I said, businessman's liberalism, not conservative, but materialist and liberal in the classical sense.
These were serious thinkers. These were serious writers. But as you point out, by the early 1960s, this whole project was dead. They broke with Barry Goldwater. Clinton Rossiter, who had written the key seminal book about this new conservatism, had rebuked his association with conservatism. He actually wrote a piece in Time magazine, "I am not now and never have been a conservative." And Peter Varick looked back on the 60s on the political language that he helped popularize and wondered what went wrong. Conservatism at that point belonged to the right, not the center. So I'm trying to get some sense of this. So what was it about Buckleyism that was different? So these guys were sort of centrist moderates who were aligned with Eisenhower. Buckley came along and shoved them in the dustbin. How was he different than them?
I don't know if he consciously, I think he did consciously do it, but shoving them in the dustbin seems a bit harsh.
Okay.
This is the question that I wanted to get at with this piece in particular, because as I say, you can find references to Varick, and others around, but no one really answers what happened to them. Why did they just give up? And in some respects, they did just give up because they saw the writing on the wall. And I try and answer it in a few ways. One is by saying the Buckleyite right, they had a pre-existing constituency that they were willing to appeal to. I know you said earlier that the common narrative is that Buckley came along and said, "Let there be conservatism."
Yeah.
And it's very hard to overstate how important he was as an entrepreneur and a networker for what became the conservative movement. But there, like I said, there did already exist this right wing, this Republican right wing that had a base of voters, that had funding groups, that had some journals. And Buckley was able, along with other intellectuals and writers and ideological entrepreneurs, who was able to plug into those networks, including his father, an easy connection right there. And they were able to, I think, get traction quite quickly. And also Buckley and Kirk, Russell Kirk, another key figure in this, and this national, the circle around what became National Review, they, as I say in the piece, had like a movement mentality. They were consciously thinking, we need to make a political movement. They had a background in political controversy and political activism. And so they were thinking in these terms, whereas the new conservatives were mostly academics, mostly ivory tower guys who were doing this kind of as a hobby. So that's one side of it. There was this pre-existing conservative or Republican right wing that they were able to tap into. The other side is that the new conservatives, it's unclear how much the public at the time thought they were offering something different to what liberalism represented at the time, because Cold War liberalism had its own sense of being pragmatic and being non-ideological and being tough-minded about problems like communism. And so if you have a bunch of people talking about being conservative and it's not clear to a lot of people what's different from Cold War liberalism, I don't know. For some people, it's like, why do you bother to call yourself a conservative?
Okay, so this is interesting that you would say that, because I have been struggling to understand exactly where they fit into all of this. So, for example, Viereck would say that his vision was, as you write, non-Republican, non-commercialist, non-conformist, and that he wanted to synthesize the ethical New Deal social reforms with the more pessimistic anti-mass insights of America's Burkean founders. So, for example, this would be a group of conservatives who offered that basically, you know, the tried to make a political doctrine out of original sin, that the people mm-hmm. Were not perfectible, that in fact we needed to have that skepticism about government schemes, which is, you know, profoundly conservative. But it does seem very intellectual and not very distinctive. So when Buckley came along, he put an edge on it all.
Mm-hmm.
So what was it about Buckley and Goldwater that was the breaking point? What could they not go along with? They had an idea of kind of a moderate, culturally conservative movement. What was it about Buckley and the Goldwater campaign that blew them off?
Well, they'd already been struggling with the Republicans about McCarthy, Joseph McCarthy, okay, and McCarthyism. And Buckley, in particular, and, you know, others at National Review. National Review even published something under McCarthy's name, even though it was ghostwritten. And so the new conservatives really struggled to get on with Buckley's sympathy, at the very least, for Joseph McCarthy. That was one breaking point. But it continued with the emphasis on Goldwater, who, as you know, at the time had, I think he was seen as a decent person, but with kooky ideas, dangerous mm-hmm. ideas about fighting communism to the extent that risked nuclear apocalypse. But for Viereck, and I think also for Rossiter, it was Goldwater's economics that really did them in. I think he was seen as too bluntly laissez-faire, too eager to privatize Social Security or do it away entirely, to privatize elements of the New Deal. And it was these economic steps that would kind of turn the clock back that the new conservatives saw as ultimately radical and ultimately kind of the businessman's liberalism that they had rejected in their formulation of new conservatism.
And you pointed out how they kind of split up, that they were primarily academics. They didn't have the movement mentality. They didn't have a journal. They didn't have a magazine that was their, you know, that was their, you know, their focal point. Unlike the, you know, Buckleyite right, most of these new conservatives were usually, you know, professors who basically went back to academic scholarship, and they also didn't have a political figurehead. That's why I was asking you about Eisenhower. I mean, Eisenhower obviously was not a movement conservative or an intellectual, so they didn't have a Goldwater or a Reagan. So a lot of them ended up really kind of becoming Democrats.
Well, some of them did. Yeah, some of them did. Some of them, like I say, were already kind of leaning that way before John Halliwell, a political scientist professor at Duke. He went to a National Review dinner for conservative political scientists, and he had to admit before he accepted the invitation that he liked the welfare state, he liked Keynesian economics, and he liked JFK and the New Frontier. And Buckley, who was personally very gracious, had come along anyway. But even some of the more Republican members of the New Conservatives, the ones who had more of a direct political plan, because, you know, as you say, New Conservatism was kind of hid in the clouds, conservatism in a lot of ways. But some of them did have specific political plans and worked for the Eisenhower administration, trying to come up with, I guess, a conservative spin on moderate Republicanism. But even these guys, people like McGeorge Bundy and August Heckscher, did wind up working for the Kennedy administration, and sometimes very prominently.
You talk about their legacy, the right wing proponents of free enterprise, small government, and a blunter anti-communism that paid less attention to the far right supplanted the new conservatives. The Buckleyites incorporated much of the new conservatism's traditionalism, terminology, their critiques of liberalism, but they wedded to that laissez-faire anti-government right. And you say America is perhaps poor for the loss of this conservative inheritance. Specifically, what are you referring to? That the loss of what? What got lost in this transition among conservatives into sort of a harder edged conservatism that we saw in the 60s?
I think a few things. One is a willingness or a strong willingness to police the right. The new conservatives, and they got criticized heavily by the Buckleyites for this, but they were very willing to look at right-wing figures, both within the United States and also kind of dictate right-wing anti-communist dictators, and be very critical of them. And I think the conservative movement has struggled on this front, especially lately. Another thing is a sense of government that governs. Rossiter calls the American right the world's first anti-government right wing. You know, historically speaking, if we look around the world, right wings tend to be the party of strong government, central government, and authority. And there are elements of that, I think, in American conservatism. But you have a political movement and a political culture that is, in a lot of ways, small government, but that often morphs into anti-government. And I think it becomes very hard to govern effectively when you have an anti-government position. It often becomes bad government. And then a third thing that I think gets lost in the mix is a sense of moderation and proportionality. I think the conservative movement tends towards apocalypticism about the outcome of, you know, every election, every presidential election, or, you know, every kind of moment becomes, is this the end of America as we know it, or is it going to be revived in a heroic way? And I think the new conservatives had a sense of evolutionary development and moderation that gave them perhaps a little bit more proportion about politics and maybe life.
This is also the difference between American conservatism and, say, British conservatism. I think a lot of American conservatives have a hard time getting their heads around the fact that the British Conservative Party is very, very different than the Conservative Party in this country.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that's one of the things that the new conservatives got criticized for, and perhaps appropriately. They were often Anglophiles. Some of them were just straight up English expats in the U.S., and their sense of what the Conservative Party could be or ought to be was very different to the one that I think fits within American culture. You know, American culture does have an emphasis on freedom as kind of its basic idea and ideal. And that I don't think always comports with conservatism, especially as the new conservatives understood it. Russell Kirk, who I mentioned more as a Buckleyite kind of figure, but in a lot of ways, he's the one who sucked up the air for the new conservatives and replaced them as the face of conservatism before Buckley. He was criticized as being 150 years or born 150 years late and in the wrong country. And I think that applies to some of the new conservatives as well.
So is there a distinction that's worth diving into between being conservative and being right wing? Because the way you're describing it, it sounds like the new conservatives were trying to claim conservatism for a conservative sensibility versus, say, a more right-wing worldview.
That's the way that I ended up putting it. And I think you could go in circles talking about what conservative is and what, and I have done for almost a decade now, so let's not dive too deep into it. But I think when you're talking about the right wing, certainly in the American context, it so often means, at least to some extent, business interests, small government, low tax, whereas conservative, I think, at least on the face of it and the way that the new conservatives were using it, means a defense of, you know, what is good and valuable and what society already has that's worth conserving. And I think one of the genius strokes of movement conservatism is they, through folks like Buckley and folks like Kirk, they kind of married those two things, and they said, yes, things that are valuable and things that are good in society are the same as the right-wing principles that have long existed on the American right. And the new conservatives, I think, are an important reminder that not everyone always thought so, and that marriage between conservatism or the conservative sensibility and right-wing politics in the American setting is not a natural one necessarily. It was one that was created at the time.
Who are, if anyone, who are the heirs now of the new conservative? What leading figure is most influenced or sounds most like them, do you think?
That is a tough question. The piece that I wrote came out of research that I did a long while ago, and I know that when you read the piece, it sort of reminded you of where the Bulwark are now. And so I don't think it's an accident that it came out through the Bulwark. So I don't know. I'm not trying to flatter you here. I do think that some of the noises that the Niskanen Center are making fit within this tradition. And I think Jeffrey Cabot-Servais, who's a fantastic historian, his work on moderate Republicans, I think, fits very close to the tradition that the new conservatives were talking about, and in perhaps a more practical way. But those guys mostly died out. And so looking towards who might be today's equivalent, I think that's tough. Lamb.
Well, okay, but now he's a Democrat. There are some hints that I've seen that George Will was influenced by some of the leading intellectual figures of the new conservative movement. Do you see any of that in his work?
Yeah, I think especially in his earlier work, Statecraft is Soulcraft, I think he gets at this idea that the purpose of government is to govern, and that requires wisdom and thought, but it also requires actually trying to govern. And all credit to George Will. I think he's trended perhaps in a more libertarian direction since that book. But at the time, I think he did have an influence from the new conservatives. He also had a lot of colleagues who came from the Straussian world who have a similar, or at least the East Coast Straussians had a sense of the purpose of government is to govern. So I think George Will was influenced in that direction as well.
Well, you know, what I found fascinating about your piece was the way it filled in rather dramatic gaps for me in my thinking about the conservative movement. Because, as you point out, these guys are largely forgotten. But the whole Eisenhower era has kind of been written out of the entire conservative history. People don't talk about Eisenhower or Eisenhower as a conservative. In fact, the dominant references from the Buckley right are a rejection of Eisenhower, a very conscious rejection of Eisenhower Republicanism, that Eisenhower Republicanism was too incrementalist, that it wasn't radical, it wasn't reformist enough. And as a result, in conservative literature, not only do you not see references to Rossiter or Viereck, but, you know, virtually nothing about where does Dwight Eisenhower fit into the history of conservatism. I mean, you can read about Hayek, or you can read about H.O. Mencken, or you can even read about some of the things the anti-New Dealers wrote, but Eisenhower's kind of a blank spot.
Well, I think that's right. The thing about Eisenhower in terms of the conservative movement is he did have an important role in conservatism, but it was a negative one. The Buckleyite conservatives in the 50s, especially in National Review, consciously formed conservatism as a response to a criticism of Eisenhower. I think you often get the most dramatic developments in right-wing thinking when there's a perceived failure by the center-right. I don't think those developments are necessarily good ones or even thoughtful ones, but they're the most dramatic leaps. And so when you had 8 years of Eisenhower, and you know, the threat of four more through Nixon, you have the Buckleyite right being creative and taking leaps further to the right in response to him. So the because they fundamentally saw Eisenhower as indistinct from the New Deal, they called them Me Too Republicans. You know, here's the Republican platform. It's more of the same of what the New Deal was offering. Maybe it's going to be a little cheaper.
Right. It wasn't that big goal, a choice, not an echo. This was the major theme.
Mm-hmm. Goldwater represented a choice against the New Deal, whereas the modern republicanism of Eisenhower and Nixon at the time, and I think in a lot of ways the new conservatives, was merely an echo of what FDR and Truman were offering.
So when Barry Goldwater, who is one of the heroes in my telling of the conservative movement, but when he said extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice, these folks would have thought of that as a repudiation of actual conservatism, an embrace of that kind of extremism.
Yeah, I mean, that line has a funny history. But I think so. People like Peter Varick, who in his very first essay, But I'm a Conservative, on the new conservatism, he consciously rejects what he calls dynamism because he thinks that leads to extreme politics and ultimately the path to totalitarian politics, either of the right or the left. And I think Goldwater...
What did he mean by dynamism?
He meant, mass political movements that filtered up into kind of charismatic leaders or cult of personality leaders who used the state as in ways to kind of enact mass power, I suppose. I'm not putting that the most coherently, but he had in mind things like fascism. You know, he's writing in 1941, so fascism, communism, Nazism.
And his father, of course, had famously been one of the leading pro-Hitler, pro-Nazi writers in America. I mean, so he had some really serious family issues that he was working through.
He had some very serious family issues. I didn't put it in the piece, but his brother actually died fighting against fascism for the American army. And he dedicated one of his books on conservatism to him. And Varick said that he could never be morally indifferent toward anything connected with fascism. It was deeply personal for him. But at the same time, he was deeply anti-communist as well. And he saw a lot of the left liberals of the time as both smug, but also very soft or fellow traveling with communism. So he found himself, and this is true of all the new conservatives, they found themselves in an awkward middle where they were plague on both your houses, but they also didn't have particularly many friends.
So when he heard Goldwater and the Republican right embracing extremism is no vice, he thought of that. That was an echo for things that he was very consciously rejecting in his ideology and his life. He was troubled by that from a conservative point of view.
Right. Exactly. I'm not sure exactly what his thoughts were, but I think, yeah, it ran exactly against his conception of conservatism as.
So where did he end up? What ended up happening with him?
Yeah, that's a good question. He kind of receded into the background. He had sort of two parallel careers. He was a poet and he was a historian, and he ended up focusing on his poetry and on Russian history, where he taught at Mount Holyoke. But it's kind of in academia, it's sort of weird if you split your energies. And I don't think, because he was a poet and a historian, neither of those, he sort of peaked in the 40s and early 50s and then kind of tapered off. He had personal crises in his marriage and things like that. But he ended up being a respected teacher, but at a fairly small college. And it's hard to say.
But he was one of those guys that say, where did it go wrong? Which again, this why it kind of resonates why we're having this conversation today. These conservatives who are, really thought that they were part of the conservative movement, were trying to articulate a conservative vision, and at a certain point looked around and asked themselves, this is not what we had in mind. I did not sign up for this.
Right. When I was writing it, I thought about, you know, is it worth adding a section at the end that's, you know, explicit lessons for Never Trumpers? I ended up not, because I like to be a bit more subtle about these things. But I think there are lessons here, and they're, you know, have a mentality.
Hey, yeah. we could use that now, because you didn't put it in the article. But so what would the explicit lesson be? As I was reading this and listening to the discussions contemporaneously after, Clinton Rossiter's book came out, it did strike me as a very similar moment. This question of what was conservatism? Is there a centrist conservatism? Is it going to be, you know, defined by the right wing? So what would you have said? Do you remember? And what would the explicit advice that you would have given to Never Trumpers?
Yeah, well, I think one is have a movement mentality. You know, look for other people like you and build that consciously. I think try and have some practical policies. Try and have practical implications for your philosophies. And also look for political standard bearers, people that, you know, even if they're not perfect, at least you can say this is the person carrying us forward. Maybe, you know, that's an exogenous factor to some extent. And I don't know, maybe just don't give up. The new conservatives, I think, were happy enough to go, well, perhaps we are just liberals after all. And as I say, I think something was lost in that process.
So in some ways, you'd mentioned this a couple of times, that one of the breaking points was McCarthyism. You know, you think about Trumpism and McCarthyism as being somehow historically related, that it was one of the most extreme, in many ways, indefensible reactions. But rather than, you know, being repudiated by the right embraced McCarthyism. And that probably in a lot of ways, as I read the histories, it kind of reads like a sort of a distant echo of the way the right embraced Trumpism. Do you see that analogy, or is that too strained?
No, I think I certainly see it. One of the ways that it comes through is where you have, you know, people who are considered the high expositors of conservative thought, people like Wilmore Kendall and James Byrne. I'm going a bit in the weeds here on conservative intellectual history, but you have these highbrow thinkers who—
See, I know them.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
See, they saw themselves as on the McCarthy issue. They often saw themselves as McCarthyites or anti McCarthyites. And I think you know, James Burnham in particular, he left his kind of left wing associations because he saw himself as an anti McCarthyite. And I think that's one of the weird echoes of today, where you have the anti Trump press. And I think a lot of the conservatives framed themselves in that way, and I think that was such a strange echo to see that today. But yeah, I think the bullying, the culture war element to it, you know, before the term was a thing, I think that's echoed strongly.
And of course, you actually have the personal ties. You know, Roy Cohn being the one of McCarthy's key aides, who then goes on to have a longtime association with Donald Trump, and Donald Trump famously wanted an attorney general was his Roy Cohn. So it's like this, the breadcrumbs are not difficult to follow if you go in that particular direction to get back to Joe McCarthy. And of course, it's always been sort of painful for me to realize that one of, you know, William F. Buckley's first books was his defense of Joe McCarthy, who of course was a Wisconsin United States Senator. I have to keep remembering that. So, you know, the history of all of this is so difficult to sort of parse out, because there are so many different, I guess there are so many different directions that the right could have taken. But reading this, I think is, you know, I guess it's sobering for me. And your advice about not giving up, not just disappearing from the field, I think is very, very important. But also how, you know, really, you know, sometimes these movements are very, very small. Mm-hmm. You know, we think of them as these, you know, mass demographic shifts, but conservatism has always been at least the idea has always been, you know, held by a relatively small number of thought leaders. I guess the question is whether or not the right wing now is really about ideas at all. And I guess that's kind of one of the questions that I have, is whether or not we're in a post-intellectual phase, whether any of this now has any relevance to what's happening to the right. Do you follow my question here?
Yeah, I think it's hard to answer. I have a piece coming out next in the next issue of the National Interest, and in that I look at some of the foundational ideas of conservatism, especially through the guys I mentioned earlier, Burnham and Kendall, and I suggest that they laid out, even in a highbrow and in an often insightful way, laid out the logics and kind of the themes that today's right, today's conservative movement still dwell on, anti-liberalism, the threat of the left, kind of apocalypticism about elections, even kind of an anti-democratic sentiment that have become even disconnected from the insights themselves and just become kind of the tropes and the themes of the right today. So I think there's a connection there, but I think in a lot of ways the ideas have left the right. You know, it wasn't that long ago when conservatives were calling themselves the party of ideas, and yeah. I don't know if many Republicans are waving that flag at the moment.
Well, while I have you on, one of the other questions that I should have asked this a little bit earlier, but in terms of the new conservatives versus the more dominant conservative strain, does race play a role in this, or attitudes toward race? Was that a dividing point between this group and, you know?
I was just thinking, we haven't talked about race here at all. And to some extent, the answer is no. Race wasn't particularly important for this juncture, and that's partly because the new conservatives and Cold War liberalism at the time was not that attentive to race, to their shame. And a lot of them later admitted, certainly the Cold War liberals admitted, we weren't thinking about race, and we should have been because, you know, it was staring us right in the face. But the history of the conservative movement is inextricably bound up with race and racism, unfortunately. And I think if the new conservatives hadn't broken with Goldwater by 1964, I think his principled defense of states' rights that was picked up by a lot of genuine racists would have been a breaking point had they not already broken with him.
Yeah, this is something that's worth remembering. As you look back at the civil rights legislation of 1957 and 1964, and the vast majority of Republicans voted for that, but Goldwater voted against the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and he represented the direction the Republican Party was heading in, rather than the Everett Dirksons of the world, who had been co-sponsors of the Voting Rights Act and had voted in favor of some of this stuff. And the Republican Party had at one time gotten the lion's share of the African American vote, and that's one of the most dramatic changes in the Republican Party and the posture of the Republican Party, the Southern strategy, etc. And so my sense reading this between the lines was that this group of new conservatives might not have been comfortable going in that particular direction, although I didn't see anything explicitly about that.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So are you optimistic about where the conservatives are right now? Do you see the direction? Because I have to tell you, I'm having a hard time seeing a trajectory that is not taking them more into the more extreme kind of dynamic right-wing movements that we're seeing in Europe, rather than the kinds of more sober, moderate, traditionalist approaches that people like Peter Verrick and Clinton Rossiter thought conservatives should be.
To be honest with you, Charlie, I am not optimistic either. There might be one glimmer of hope, but it's a pretty backhanded one, in the sense that the most right-wing elements of what we still call the conservative movement may be beginning to abandon the term conservative. There was that ludicrous piece in The American Mind recently where they said, we're not conservative anymore, we're counter-revolutionary, which is, I think, the exact type of thing that Verrick was very concerned about.
Where do you put that on the political spectrum? Because that is a repudiation of conservatism. I mean, where does that come from? That sort of we are the counter-revolutionaries. I mean, that seems to be at least fascist adjacent, or is that too extreme?
talking about fascism gets you in all kinds of issues here. There's a big debate going on in kind of academic circles about whether or not to call Trumpism fascist. But I think, yeah, a lot of that essay in particular struck me as I don't like saying fascist, but yeah, fascist adjacent. I know you've read the Umberto Eco essay, yes. Fascism, and yes. I think it's ticking boxes there. And the language used in it was very extreme, I think, for the American idiom. And so I think maybe you've got folks like Jesse Kelly and Tucker Carlson and the Claremont Institute beginning to abandon conservatism. Perhaps there's an opening for a reclamation of conservatism as perhaps more more to the right than I would necessarily like it, but with an ethos of moderation that I think is important.
Well, let's leave it on that. Joshua Tate, thank you so much for joining me, particularly joining me from New Zealand.
Thank you very much for having me.
Which I think sets a record for the number of time zones we've crossed in this particular podcast. And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow and we'll do this all over again.